information right now.
Excellent, Jane. You'll be glad you did.
This is the GCN Radio Network.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at the Genesis Communication Network, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest, and hopefully we're going to have Bill Federer here in just a moment, who, of course, is really one of my favorite guests. Bill is a writer. He has written a number of books which we carry, America's God and Country, a book on the Servility of St. Nicholas, and a book on St. Patrick, and a book on George Washington Carver, and there's just so many books. I can't list them all right now because we've got Bill. He's written a new book on the Muslim faith and, of course, how it impacts on America, the world today. And I think it's so important that you understand the foundation of the Muslim faith. Now, there are a lot of people out there who are Muslims who really don't understand most of what you're going to learn from Bill and, of course, what you can get from some of the material that we offer here. But, you know, what the Muslims need is to means of getting away from that faith. And, of course, the only hope for them is Christianity. In fact, Christianity is the hope for the world. An entirely different outlook on the world, on the individual, on women, and, of course, on how you deal with your enemies. Bill Federer, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, Dr. Stan, great to be with you.
So I'm going to let you take off and tell us about this exciting new book you've written.
Well, the title of the book is What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam and the United States. And recently, we had our first Muslim congressman swear into office upon a Quran. Now, this is different because every single other congressman and senator and president has sworn into office with their hand upon a Bible. And so this is the first time somebody's sworn in upon a Quran. And so I thought it would be interesting to look up and put into the book verses from the Quran. This is what surah, and the word surah means verse. Surah 5:17 says, "Infidels are those who declare God is Christ, the Son of Mary." Surah 5:73 says, "Infidels are those who say God is one of three in a Trinity." Surah 4:101 says, "Infidels are your sworn enemies." Surah 9:123 says, "Make war on the infidels who dwell around you." Surah 47:4 says, "When you meet the infidel on the battlefield, strike off their heads." You contrast this to Jesus that said, "When you get struck on one cheek, turn the other and love your enemies and do good to those that hate you." Surah 48:29 says, "Muhammad is Allah's apostle. Those who follow him are ruthless to the infidels." Surah 66:9 says, "Prophet, make war on the infidels." Surah 551 says, "Believers, take neither the Jew nor the Christian for your friends." It goes on and on. Here's one that says, Surah 47:4, "Therefore, when you meet an unbeliever in fight, smite at their necks. At length, when you have thoroughly subdued them, bind them in a bond firmly on them. Thereafter is the time for either generosity or ransom." Surah 5:33 says, "The only reward for those who make war on Allah and his messengers will be that they will be killed or crucified and have their hands and feet cut off on alternate sides." Anyway, am I missing something? I mean, am I taking these out of context? And so what I decided to do is to research the 1,400-year history of Islam to see if historically Muslims have interpreted jihad as just a personal internal struggle to improve themselves, or is it a global vision, a worldview that has a global conquest aspect to it?
Well, of course, the president says that Islam is a religion of peace. But that is the peace of slavery, the peace of the grave. We'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest, trying to understand what we are really up against today.
Are you looking for a one-stop shop to find all your favorite books and videos? Look no further. Northern Voice Bookstore has everything you need. Hundreds of titles, from self-defense, survival, and financial freedom, to history, politics, conspiracy, and everything you need to know about the New World Order. You can order everything you need on the web, 24 hours a day, at northernvoicebookstore.com. Or send $2 for our latest catalog to Northern Voice Bookstore, Post Office Box 281, Wildwood, PA, 15091. Northern Voice Bookstore offers a broad range of different perspectives and believes strongly that the American people need alternative sources of information in order to understand the society they live in today. You won't find a better selection of books or videos anywhere. So make Northern Voice Bookstore your bookstore. Visit us online at northernvoicebookstore.com or send $2 for our latest catalog to Northern Voice Bookstore, P.O. Box 281, Wildwood, PA 15091.
Now you can bring Berkey purification power anywhere with the Sport Berkey filtration bottle. Ideal for sporting games, camping or boating, or Sport Berkey is small enough to store in your glove box, so it's ideal backup for unexpected emergencies like blackouts, floods, or earthquakes. It's simply the best personal water filtration system available. So effective you can drink raw, untreated water from lakes, rivers, and streams. Unlike other sport bottles, the Sport Berkey's patented filter formulation is so powerful it removes cysts, parasites, harmful bacteria, and chemicals like herbicides and pesticides. It even reduces radon 222, lead, and other heavy metals. This lightweight, rugged 22-ounce filter is small enough to go everywhere, so take one to work and keep another in your glove box for emergencies. Get the Berkey Sport for only $39. Get two for $70 by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438. Order your Berkey Sport today. That's toll-free, 888-803-4438, or order on the web at berkeywater.com.
The disciples asked Jesus in Matthew 24, "What shall be the signs of thy coming and the end of the world?" "You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars, for nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, disease, and earthquakes in many places." We are living in this time of Earth's history. Many people are trying to understand the climactic world events in light of human wisdom. But without the wisdom of God, this is impossible. 2 Peter says, "We have a more sure word of prophecy, and you do well if you take heed. But first know this, that no prophecy of the Scripture is of any private interpretation." The Bible says, "We'd like you to receive this new offer, Packet B, the Unholy Alliance." These materials document the global leaders, political and religious, behind the scenes. You will receive information regarding America and prophecy, tyrants and wars, the New World Order, and much more. As always, these materials are shipped to you at no charge. Please call 1-888-211-1715. That's 1-888-211-1715. And ask for Packet B.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at the Genesis Communication Network, and our special guest today is with us, and certainly we're discussing the Muslim faith. Our special guest is Bill Federer. And go ahead, Bill. What have you found as you begin to analyze the fundamentals of the Muslim religion, which I suspect most Muslims really don't understand? Now, I think that there are a growing number of people who are turning to this radical form of Islam that has really been latent for many years. But, many of them are turning to this really because of their intense hatred of what's going on in the world today. But, of course, they're going from bad to worse, because when you embrace this type of religion, when you embrace jihad, why, of course, you are really destroying the very essence of what humanity is about. So pick up the story, Bill.
Well, Muhammad was born in 570 A.D. over in Arabia. His dad died before he was actually born. His mom died when he was 6 years old. His grandfather died when he was 8, and so therefore he was an orphan, and he was given to his uncle, Abu Talib. And his uncle was a textile merchant and a camel driver, and so Muhammad went with him on these camel rides, where they would run into the Zoroastrians of Persia, and then the pagans of Arabia, and the Jews, and the Christians. And Muhammad was illiterate, so he couldn't read. All he knew was the oral stories that he heard. And so when he came in touch with the Persians, who were Zoroastrians, which was an ancient monotheistic religion. He heard stories about the seven levels of heaven. And, of course, in the Quran, there is a story of Muhammad saying he went to the seventh level of heaven. Well, clearly, this is something that came from the Zoroastrians. He talks about jinns, who were spirits. And, you know, plural was jinni or genie. And these spirits would accompany people, and that's where we get the word genius, because a genius was, they thought, a spirit would follow you around and tell you all the answers instead of you being, you know, it was very smart. But also the Zoroastrians had a sensual heaven, a sensual paradise, where when you would die, you would go there, and there would be fairies, or what they call houris, which were very voluptuous women who were forever young and would satisfy all your desires. So that was the influence that came upon Muhammad. And so he wrote in the Quran these different verses, we shall join them unto fair women with big, beautiful, lustrous eyes, Surah 44:54, reclining on ranged couches, and when we wed them unto the fair ones with their wide, lovely eyes, Surah 52:20. Surah 55:56 says, in them will be maidens, chaste, restraining their glances, whom no man or jinn before them has ever touched. There will be companions with big, beautiful, lustrous eyes, like pearls, well guarded. You know, it talks about you know, high-breasted women. Anyway, this was came from the Zoroastrians. Then Muhammad ran into the Arabs of Arabia, and they were pagans. They had over 360 different gods. Each community had its own favorite god, and the word Allah just means the god. So in each town, they had their own Allah. Well, Mecca happened to be one of the biggest towns, and their favorite god was the moon god. They had a triad of three gods, the moon god, the sun god, who was female, and then a daughter god named Venus, who was Venus. And but the moon god, moon was considered to be the highest light in the sky, therefore it was the greatest, so they called it the god or Allah. And they had a meteorite rock, or a piece of glass impact, you know, when a meteor hits sand and it's really hot and it forms a black stone. And so they thought that this stone had fallen from the moon. And so they put it into the Kaaba, which was a square room there in Mecca. And the Arabs, pagans, would walk around it and kiss it and fast 1 month out of the year, you know, and bow toward it five times a day. And so Muhammad heard about that. You know, it's important to emphasize this was pre-Islam. This was pre-Muhammad. The Arab pagans did these things. And then the Jews had their scriptures, but they were locked away in their synagogues, because this was 700 years before the printing press was invented, and so they were very valuable. And so the Jews had their oral stories called the Talmud or the Midrash, and they would repeat these, and so Muhammad would hear these. And some of them were the you know, apocalypse of Abraham and the story of Enoch, and so these were stories that made their way into the Quran. And then there was the Christian influence when Muhammad would go on these camel rides. But it so happened that the area where Muhammad lived was where there were a lot of Christian heresies. And they mostly dealt over the nature of Christ. There was Nestorianism, which believed Jesus was all man. There was the Monophysites, who believed Jesus had two natures, but they were in one body. There were the Docetists, who believed Jesus was all God and only appeared to be human. There were the Arians, that believed Jesus was a special creation of God for man's salvation. And the Ebionites, who said Jesus was the Messiah, but he was not divine. Anyway.
Wait a minute now. But this, you're talking, this is about a 57 AD.
Right.
This is
were all the
590 AD, right.
Now, for Orthodox Christianity, the nature of Christ was settled at the Council of Nicaea in 325, where we came up with the Nicene Creed, where Jesus is of one substance with the Father. But these other heresies were over in the Arabian area and in some of the Byzantine area. And so, a matter of fact, Muhammad was married to his first wife. He was 20 and she was 50. she had been widowed twice, and she didn't want to marry another guy that would die before her, so she married a young guy. So Muhammad was married to this wealthy widow by her cousin, who was an Ebionite Christian priest. And so the influence that Muhammad was getting as to what Christianity was this idea that Jesus was the Messiah, but he wasn't divine. these all mixed in his mind, and in sort of in a Baha'i faith type of way, he tried to reconcile all four of them. And he would go out into the desert and pray, because now that he was married to a wealthy widow, he had the free time. And there were desert fathers in Egypt, which were the, you know, the early Christian church. These guys would go out and fast and pray, trying to imitate Elijah or John the Baptist. And so Muhammad would go out. And he tells the story about how one time he went out and the spirit squeezed him. And he didn't know if it was a jinn, like a genie, you know, a jinn spirit, or later he called the spirit Gabriel. He writes about this, and this is from the Quran and the Hadith. Now, the Quran were verses, thoughts that came into his mind or came from the spirit, and he would just repeat them over and over and over and over and over again until he had them memorized. And then he would teach them to his followers and have them repeat them over and over and over until they had them memorized. It wasn't until a couple hundred years after Muhammad's death that somebody actually wrote these things down. And but then there was the Hadith. The Hadith are the oral stories that were remembered by his 15 wives and his Ghazi warriors, the people that fought in the battles with him. And so they wrote these down, and that's also, there's about 20 or 30 different Hadiths, and they have equal authority with the Quran as far as the Muslims go. Anyway, this is the Hadith of Sahih al-Bukhari, and he writes that, it says, after this, solitude became dear to him, and he would go into the cave at Hira and engage in devotion there for a certain number of nights before returning to his family, and then he would return for provisions and for a similar stay. At length, unexpectedly, the angel appeared to him and said, "Read." "I cannot read," he said, the prophet described. Then he took me and squeezed me vehemently, and then let me go, and repeated the order, "Read." "I cannot read," I said, and once again he squeezed me and let me go till I was exhausted. Then he said, "Read." I said, "I cannot read." Then he squeezed me for a third time and then let me go and said, "Read, in the name of thy Lord, which createth man from a clot." And that was Surah 96:1. So he went back to his wife Khadijah, and he was very disturbed, very scared. And of course, this differed from any biblical account, because in every single place in the Bible where an angel appeared, the first words out of the angel's mouth was, "Fear not." And so this was an angel that instilled fear. So a little bit different there. And the Hadith, Sahih al-Bukhari, continues. It says, "Then Allah's apostle returned with inspiration, his neck muscles twitching with terror, till he entered upon Khadijah. And he said, 'Cover me, cover me.' They covered him till his fear was over. And then he said, 'Oh, Khadijah, what is wrong with me?' He goes on to say, 'Oh, Khadijah, I see light and I hear sound and I fear I am mad.'" Then it goes where he would go out, and a couple different times he was going to throw himself off of a mountain, and the spirit appeared to him again and stopped him. The wife, Khadijah, took him to her cousin, who was the Ebionite Christian priest, and he was an old man by this time. It was just a week before he died. And he said, "Well, maybe this was the angel that appeared to Moses." Anyway, he died, and so Muhammad spent the next several years communing with this spirit and came up with his Quran. His first converts were his wife, Khadijah, and a daughter named Fatima, and then her father-in-law, Abu Bakr, and then one of his slaves named Zaid. And in the Quran, it says, Muhammad said, "Whoever changes his Islamic faith, kill him." And then in another hadith it says, "If your wife leaves Islam and if she does not repent, then the ruling of Allah should be carried out upon her, which is execution, because the prophet, peace and blessing be upon Allah, that whoever changes his religion and leaves Islam, execute him." And then the hadith, Sahih al-Bukhari, records, Muhammad said, "No Muslim should be killed for killing a kafir," which is an infidel or somebody that leaves the faith. So Muhammad went ahead and mixed these different faiths together and was very excited about it, and went into Medina and began to share it with the same enthusiasm of somebody that, you know, just got into a new multi-level marketing scheme and was real excited and went to all of his friends. Well, the Jews were not excited about his new faith, and neither were the Arabs and neither were the Christians, and so he was basically rejected and chased out of Mecca, and he went to Medina. And this is called the the flight, and this is in 622 A.D., and this begins the year that the Arabs call, the Muslims call year one. And Muhammad then wrote his Medina verses, which are more violent, and he changed the order of from no compulsion in religion to killing the infidel.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment with Bill Federer. Have you made preparations to look after yourself and your family in case there's a national emergency or a terrorist attack? Well, I want to tell you that the government's looking after their people. In fact, plans have been made to protect people of high-ranking position in government, but they're not making any preparations for the average individual, so you're going to have to look after yourself. If you'd like information on long-term food storage, if you'd like information on the other items you would need in case of a national emergency, why don't you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and ask for the emergency food catalog. We'll get it right off to you, and we'll get the items shipped directly from Ready Reserve Foods. That's 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. You're going to have to begin making preparations to look after yourself.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson, here for the 2007 Red Book. The commodity markets like gold, silver, copper, aluminum, and oil have exploded over the last year. This is a glaring testimony of how quickly the U.S. dollar can be devalued. Many have turned to precious metals to provide a safe haven while increasing the potential profits. Though accumulating precious metals has been a proven method for the storage of wealth, it is important that you understand the market you are getting into. Midas Resources is offering the Red Book and Silver Dollar for only $27.95. The Red Book is the number one best-selling guide to gold and silver coins. Call for your copy today. It's 800-686-2237. If you've already accumulated or plan to get into the precious metals market, you simply must have the Red Book in your library. Call 800-686-2237. That's 1-800-686-2237.
The Berkey Security Pack is your one-stop solution for unexpected emergencies. It provides you with purified water, light, power, and communications ability. The Security Pack includes a Berkey Light water purifier, an LED base, two Berkey Sport filtration bottles, the Berkey battery adapter, the Berkey MP solar charger, as well as a backup set of two Black Berkey purification elements. The Berkey Security Pack is important every day and a must during emergencies because it provides purified water, long-term low-energy lighting, backup battery power for your Berkey LEDs, free long-term solar power for communications devices such as radios, walkie-talkies, and cell phones, as well as power for small applications. Get the one-stop solution for your emergency and everyday needs. The Berkey Security Pack, a retail value of $518 for only $399 by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438. Not yet available in Iowa.
How are you feeling today? I ask because if you have health challenges, then reading our free booklet about the most amazing discovery of our time is crucial. The booklet is about an amazing fruit from Southeast Asia they call mangosteen. It's a centuries-old medicinal fruit whose time has come, and it has amassed 40 years of published research. We have information and testimonials from all over the world about the health potentials of this amazing fruit. This powerful botanical has contributed to the well-being of millions of people the world over with health concerns just like yours. You can have the 22-page e-booklet absolutely free. We'll also refer you a website with links to actual testimonials and product information. Could this fruit help you in your quest for total health? Find out why mangosteen is known as the queen of all fruits and why it is fast becoming the best-selling wellness product ever brought to the market. Your health is in your hands. Do something about it today. Call 800-681-1909. Again, that's 800-681-1909.
Well, Dr. Stan back here at the Genesis Communication Network, and our guest is William Federer. We're talking really about the Muslim faith and what it really says. And most Americans have never read this. Most Americans do not know this reference to Sharia 96, where Muhammad has the encounter with this spirit, a demonic spirit of some sort, and he really was afraid that he was demonically possessed after that. And so there are really so many references in the Muslim religion to the fact that certainly that Muhammad referred to the fact that Satan was involved in this whole religion, and of course that he himself was satanically possessed. And that's why, of course, when Salman Rushdie wrote the satanic verse, going into the background, and perhaps Bill will tell us the story, but where, of course, Muhammad actually said that Satan had actually dictated part of the Muslim faith. Why, of course, Salman Rushdie had to have a contract put out on his head, because they cannot let the average Muslim understand what their faith really involves. So pick up the story there.
Well, one of the things you go through to see some of the inconsistencies, one is what it teaches about Jesus. Now, believe it or not, the Quran does say that Jesus was born of a virgin. This is what it says in Surah 3:45. It says, "Behold, the angel said, Mary, Allah giveth thee glad tidings, a word from him. His name will be Christ, Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, held in honor in this world and the hereafter. Of the company of those nearest Allah, he shall speak in childhood and in maturity." And she says, "Oh, my Lord, how shall I have a son when no man hath touched me?" He says, "Even so, Allah createth what he willeth. When he has decreed a plan, he but saith to it, be, and it is." So here, the Quran acknowledges that Mary was a virgin and that Jesus had no earthly father. But if you say that God was Jesus's father, they will kill you, because that's blasphemy. It says later in the Quran that Allah took no wife and has no son. So here they will admit that Jesus had no earthly father, but they consider it blasphemy to say that God was Jesus's father. And it's like, okay, well, if God wasn't his father and you admit the man wasn't his father, who was his father? They don't have an answer. I mean, it's an incongruous type of a mental arrangement there. But so Muhammad went to Medina and changed the verses, and so there are the Meccan verses and the Medina verses, and it's easy to remember the MEC comes before MED in the alphabet. So the Meccan verses are first, and they are nicer to the people of the book, and there when he wanted, you know, to have them convert. When they didn't convert, he fled, was chased to Medina, and he wrote the Medina verses, which changed the direction of bowing from bowing toward Jerusalem five times a day to bowing toward Mecca. It's said to be ruthless to the people of the book. And there were Jews in Medina that did not like Muhammad, and they were actually hoping that the Meccans would win. And when the Meccans didn't win and Muhammad, drove them off, Muhammad then turned his army toward these Jews in their neighborhood and bottled them up in their neighborhood for 25 days. They, fought and they tried to get out. They couldn't. So finally, they surrendered. And Muhammad took all the men in batches and to the marketplace, and he dug these big trenches and he had them bow over and he cut off all 700 of their heads. And you read the stories that are in the Quran about this. And here's one. It says, then they surrendered, and this is what was written by Ibn Ishaq, who was the first one to write a biography of Muhammad. It says, when they surrendered, the apostle could find them in Medina in the quarter of Da al-Harath, a woman of al-Najjar. Then the apostle went out to the market of Medina, which is still the market today, and dug the trenches in it, and he set them and struck off their heads in those trenches as they were brought out to him in batches. There were 600 or 700 in all, and they put the figure. Some put the figure as high as 800 or 900. As they were being taken out in batches, the apostle asked taken out in batches to the apostle. They asked Cobb what he thought would be done with them. He replied to the Jews, "Will you never understand? Don't you see the summoner never stops, and those who are taken away do not return? By Allah, it is death." This went on until the apostle made an end of them. And then Ibn Hisham continues, it says, Zohar, an aged Jew who had saved some of Muhammad's allies of the Bani Az tribe in the Battle of Ba'ath, Talbit interceded and procured a pardon for him, including the restoration of his family and property. But when he had come out and named all the chiefs and found that they had died, one after the other, he named the chiefs, and he said, they've already been slain, and he said, what hope is there for me to live? Let me also be slain. And so when Muhammad heard this, he said, well, he shall join them in the fires of hell, and he too was beheaded.
Hold that. We'll be back in just a moment here with William Federer.
Order a copy of this show for your friends and family at GCNLive.com or call 877-300-7645.
We understand that decisions related to health can be overwhelming. That is why at ResearchedHerbs.com we take pride in offering you herbs whose safety and effectiveness have been proven time and time again. For example, did you know that Live 52, the top-selling natural herbal supplement for liver diseases since 1930, is backed by over 300 research studies and clinical trials and prescribed by more than 200,000 health professionals worldwide? In fact, the effectiveness of all the herbs featured on ResearchedHerbs.com, including those for cholesterol, blood pressure, diabetes, arthritis, cirrhosis, and hepatitis, among others, is extremely well documented. Our website, ResearchedHerbs.com, was created to empower you with the information and answers you need to make the right health decisions. Researched and proven herbs at great prices. Visit us online at ResearchedHerbs.com or call 1-800-845-3841 for more information. That's 1-800-845-3841.
Berkey Security Pack is your one-stop solution for unexpected emergencies. It provides you with purified water, light, power, and communications ability. The Security Pack includes a Berkey Light water purifier, an LED base, two Berkey Sport filtration bottles, the Berkey battery adapter, the Berkey MP solar charger, as well as a backup set of two Black Berkey purification elements. The Berkey Security Pack is important every day and a must during emergencies because it provides purified water, long-term low-energy lighting, backup battery power for your Berkey LEDs, free long-term solar power for communications devices such as radios, walkie-talkies, and cell phones, as well as power for small applications. Get the one-stop solution for your emergency and everyday needs. The Berkey Security Pack, a retail value of $518 for only $399 by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438. Not yet available in Iowa.
The ideology powering the Democrats and Republicans is not liberalism or conservatism, but globalism. Globalists are concerned with what's good for big business and the American empire instead of what's fair for the American people. The only antidote to the poison of globalism is nationalism. Start reading the Nationalist Times each month. The Nationalist Times promotes a common sense, intelligent, and passionate alternative to the reigning party line. Published monthly since 1985, the Nationalist Times is a 20-page newspaper featuring outstanding writers and columnists who don't believe in taboos or sacred cows. Be one of the many thousands of loyal readers of the Nationalist Times. Subscribe now to the Nationalist Times. Just $19 for 1 year. That's 50% off the regular price. Send your $19 subscription to the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. That's the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. Or subscribe online at our website, www.anu.org.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at the Genesis Communication Network. Our guest is William Federer. And before we go on, Bill, will you tell our listeners how they can get to your website, how they can get copies of your book?
Oh, thanks, Dr. Stan. My website is AmericanMinute.com. That's AmericanMinute.com. And then I have a toll-free telephone number, and it's 1-888-USA-WORD, 1-888-USA-WORD.
And how can they get onto your regular email list?
That's the same, AmericanMinute.com, and they can put on their email address onto the website, and they'll get the daily American Minute email.
All right, fine. And believe me, Bill Federer's material is outstanding. You'll certainly want to be getting it. Well, how much is the book itself, and what's the title again?
The title is What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam and the United States. And it retails for $20. I also have it as an e-book, an electronic Adobe e-book that, you know, I can email it to you for $10, and you can read it on your computer and do searches, which is a really neat feature. That's also available on the website, AmericanMinute.com.
Whatever America needs to know about Islam?
Right. What every American needs to know about the Quran, A History of Islam and the United States.
A History of Islam and the United States. Okay, fine. In fact, if you would send me a copy of that book, I think we're going to go ahead and carry it. It sounds like just what we need right now for people to be able to understand what we're up against, the real beliefs of these people, and especially those who have returned to this more radical form of Islam. So you pick up the story from there.
Well, thanks. Muhammad fought in 26 battles and 86 raids, and in his lifetime, he conquered all of Arabia, and then his followers conquered all of North Africa. And most people forget that North Africa was Christian. St. Augustine of Hippo was from Carthage, North Africa. Mark, who wrote Mark's Gospel, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Mark started the Coptic Christian Church in Egypt and evangelized there. And when the Muslims swept through, they moved his bones to Venice. And that's what St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice is. There were 250 Catholic dioceses in northern Africa. And, of course, this is well before the Reformation. But they were all subjugated by the Muslims. There was a new military invention called the stirrup. The stirrup, sure, the one that goes around a horse, you know. The nomads in Mongolia would tie a rope around a horse and then leave two loops to put their big toes in because they would ride horse barefoot. Well, in the 5th century A.D., that made its way down to China, and they made the loop bigger so you could stick in your whole foot. And then the next century, that made it to Persia, where they stuck in a metal bar and turned it into the stirrup that we have today so that they could put the full power of a galloping horse behind the sword. And so that's why the Muslims had these curved swords so they could slice somebody in half while they're riding at a full gallop. Prior to the invention of the stirrup, you would ride on a horse and then get off the horse and fight, you know. But when Muhammad and his Ghazi warriors, if you fought in a battle with Muhammad, you were called the Ghazi warrior. Well, they would go and strike terror into these towns by riding in, and then the people would submit because they didn't have, this was a new military, it's like a blitzkrieg. And so there's even a story that's been passed down for centuries when Caliph Umar came into Alexandria, North Africa, which had been Christian, and that's where they translated the Septuagint, the Hebrew scriptures, into Greek. But there was the largest library in the world in Alexandria, North Africa, and it had books that went back all the way to Abraham's day. But the Caliph came in and is said that every book that does not agree with the Quran should be destroyed, and every book that does agree with the Quran is redundant because we have the Quran, so destroy them all. Anyway, then the Muslims went into Persia, and Persia had been at war with the Byzantine Christians in the Holy Land. Matter of fact, the Zoroastrians of Persia destroyed every church in the Holy Land except the one in Bethlehem, because there was a mural of the Magi on the wall, the three wise men. You know, they were the Zoroastrians of Persia. Anyway, so both the Byzantine Empire and the Zoroastrian Persian Empire were weakened because they were fighting each other. So the Muslims, with this new military technology of the stirrup, were able to sweep in there. And there is the story of when the Persians were fighting the Muslims, that in about 632 A.D., that the Persian emperor's name was Yazgard. And Yazgard sent out an emissary to the Muslims and said this. This is a quote. It says, "Our emperor asks if you would be agreeable to peace on the condition that the Tigris would be the boundary between you and us, that whatever is with you on the western side is yours, and whatever is on the eastern side would remain ours. And if this does not satisfy your land hunger, then nothing will satisfy you." The Muslim commander, Sa'd ibn Waqqas, responded that the Muslims were not hungry for land, that they were fighting to convert the Persians to Islam. Now, the importance of this, Dr. Sand, is this changed warfare forever. Prior to this, all warfare was simply imperial conquest. It was a king, an emperor, an Alexander the Great, wanting to enlarge the land that was under his dominion. But there was not the desire to make the people change their religions. Even Rome when it conquered an area, would simply take that country's god and stick it in the pantheon with all the other country's gods, but there was no effort to make those people abandon their religion. Well, Islam was different. And so then the Muslims swept through Persia. They swept through the Byzantine Empire, all the Holy Land. And then they came up to Constantinople in 680 and 690 A.D., and then finally in 717. And there were about five different attempts that they made to conquer Constantinople. But the Greeks there had a military advantage called Greek fire, where they took oil and sawdust and mixed it into a napalm-type mixture and put it in brass containers and pumped it up under pressure and would spray it out on the enemy's ships with a torch to light it on fire. And this was like napalm, and so these Muslims had no defense against this, and so they retreated. And then they were stopped, and they conquered all of Spain and into France. And finally, in 732, they were stopped at the Battle of Tours in France by Charles Martel, the Frankish king who was the grandfather of Charlemagne. Now, Muhammad died in 632, and in 732 is when they were stopped in France. I mean, within 100 years. And now, when they were stopped in France and at Constantinople, they began to rewrite their theology, saying that, yes, we will conquer the world, but maybe it will be in the distant future. And so that was the beginning of moderate Islam. So Muhammad divided the world into two houses. There was the House of Islam and the House of War. In Arabic, it's pronounced Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb, H-A-R-B. And so they see the world as Muslim and gonna be Muslim. The whole non-Muslim world is called the House of War. And so a violent Muslim thinks that Islam will conquer the world now, and a moderate or lax Muslim thinks that Islam will conquer the world sometime in the distant future. And so go ahead and get along with everybody in the present. Well, the Muslims were stopped going into Europe at this time in 717 A.D. and then 732 in France. And so they began to spread eastward into India and Persia and China, Russia, into the Indonesia and the Philippines. But they were running into the Mongolians. Now, in the 13th century was Genghis Khan, and he conquered Genghis Khan had the largest land empire in world history. Genghis Khan's Mongolian Empire went from Japan and Korea all the way over to Hungary, to Austria, to the Middle East, to Africa, up to Russia, and down to India. And the Mongolians had a style of warfare where they would ride in on a horse, and they would kill the men, and they would take the women, and then they would plunder. And as they began to fight these Muslims who were spreading eastward, it never occurred to the Mongolians to make the Muslims change their religion. So even the ones they captured, they would hear about this Islamic faith. And they began to hear that they could continue their killing of the men, the infidels, the taking the women captive, the plundering, only now they could do it with the blessing of Allah. And so one of the Mongolian tribes called the Turks converted en masse, the whole entire tribe, and they began to spread Islam back westward with the new violent, the old violent way. They were breathing new life into the conquering the world now part of Islam. And so with the help of these Mongolian Turks, Islam not only began to conquer areas in Russia, but began to spread into Asia Minor. Asia Minor is where the seven churches mentioned in the book of Revelation are. That's where the Apostle John spoke, the Apostle Paul spoke. Matter of fact, Jesus spoke the Armenian language of Aramaic. I mean, this was as Christian of an area as you can get. And Murat the First was the first sultan that went in there, and he would not only take the land and the crops and the wealth from the Christians, he would take their children. It was called the Janissary, where they would take the boys from 7 to 14 years old away from the Muslims, and force these boys into the Muslim military, force them to convert, and then put them on the front lines when they would attack the next Christian city. So they would use the children of the Christians to attack the Christians. And these Janissaries became a very powerful military force because they could not go home after the battle was over. After the Muslims fought, they would go home to their families, their multiple wives. When, you know, in Europe, when the feudal lords would fight, they'd go back to their homes. Well, these Janissaries, these Christian boys that were forced to become Muslim fighters, they couldn't go back home. They couldn't marry. They had to look as the Sultan, as their father. And if they were more delicate boys, they became part of the Muslim pederasty, of the boy sodomy that was rampant in the Sultans and the upper class there in the Muslim countries. And anyway, with the help of the Janissaries, the Muslims finally conquered Constantinople, which was the capital of the world. It was a 1,000-year-old Christian city started by Constantine, and the sultan that conquered it was Mehmet II, a 21-year-old sultan, and he wanted to get his hands on the most powerful military technology of the day, gunpowder. And the Marco Polo had brought the gunpowder back from China in, you know, the 1300s, and the 13th century, and then it finally got developed into this corned gunpowder where they, you know, mix it and let it dry to a paste and then crumble it up into granules, and then it was more explosive. And so there was a Hungarian cannon maker that offered his services to Constantinople, but they couldn't afford to pay him. So he defected and worked for Sultan Mehmet II. And they took all the church bells from the churches that they had destroyed and melted them down, and this Hungarian cannon maker made the largest cannons in the world. One of them was 27 feet long. It could shoot a 1,200-pound stone cannonball over a mile. You could hear it 10 miles away. The cannonball sunk 6 feet in the ground. It took them 140 days to haul this cannon to the walls of Constantinople. But this sort of reminds you of the current situation where the Russian nuclear scientists couldn't afford to get paid, and so they offered their services to the another Muslim leader who wants to have a cannon that can shoot not gunpowder but nuclear power around the world. And then there were the globalists. That Constantinople, being the Byzantine capital, was had rivals of the Italian city-states of Venice and Genoa. And Venice and Genoa would actually trade with the Muslims, even selling them military arms that they would use against the Byzantines, against Constantinople. So here, these Italian city-states, these Venetians and Genoese, they weren't interested in preserving Western civilization. They just wanted to make a buck. They wanted to profit, and they were selling out the Western world to do it. Anyway, the Mehmet II finally conquered Constantinople in 1453, and this cut off all the trade routes across land from Western Europe to get to India and China. And so Western Europeans tried to come up with an alternative route to get to India and China, and in 1492, a guy named Columbus said, "I know how to get there, sail west." And so Columbus thought the islands he discovered were around India, so he named the inhabitants the Indians. He thought that Haiti was Japan and that Cuba was the tip of China. It highlights the fact that Columbus would have never set sail had not there been a jihad over in Europe, which conquered Constantinople and cut off the land trade routes to India and China. Well, then the Muslims continued, and they, in 1600, an interesting story. And interrupt me at any time, Dr. Stan. In 1600, there was a British military officer who offered his services to the Austrian and Hungarian army. And this person's name was John Smith. And John Smith fought the Muslims there in Transylvania and in Hungary. There was a fortress where the Muslims took over and cut off all the heads of the Christian defenders, hung them as ornaments around the walls of the fortress. And so the Christians were laying siege to it, and the Muslims challenged the Christians to a David and Goliath type of challenge. You know, you put out your best warrior and we'll put out ours. Well, they picked John Smith, and he fought and won and cut off the head of the Muslim warrior. And the Muslim's friend challenged John Smith to try to regain the honor, and so John Smith cut off his head, and then it happened a third time. And so that's why he got the title Captain John Smith. And Captain John Smith then was in a battle with these Muslims, and about 10,000 Christians were killed. John Smith was lying in the field, left for dead. He was wounded. But the plunderers saw that he had armor on, and they thought he would be more valuable alive. They took him and, sure enough, sold him as a slave. He was purchased and sent down to Constantinople to be a servant for this one wealthy Muslim. And John Smith writes the story that his wife took a liking to him, although nothing intimate happened, but the wife wanted him to be treated better. And he was just in his early 20s at this point. And so she sends Captain John Smith off to her brother to work on his farm. The brother, though, strips him naked, puts a metal ring around his neck, puts him in irons, and sends him out to be a slave of the slave in the fields and thrash, you know, wheat and so forth. One day, John Smith is out there, and the guy's beating him. Nobody's around. John Smith jumps up, kills the guy, dresses himself in the guy's clothes, buries the guy in the straw, takes the guy's horse and rides off for several weeks to Russia, gets into a Muscovite garrison, and they take the metal ring off his neck. He finds his way across Poland, back to Transylvania. After the battle, he gets a reward for fighting, goes to the Mediterranean, fights the Muslim Barbary pirates, and captures some ships, then makes his way back to England in 1605, and in 1606, he leaves to found the first permanent English settlement in America called
Jamestown. We're out of time. God bless. Wonderful story. Thanks so much, Bill.
American Discount Home Medical Equipment sells at discount prices. We sell wheelchairs, oxygen equipment, hospital beds, commodes, bath safety products, walkers, and other items needed for the care of your loved one at home. Our phone number is 1-800-956-6616. We sell at one half of retail price or less. We have free shipping and no sales tax for any shipment outside of California. You can expect to receive the item within 7 days. Our website address is www.home-med-equip.com. Again, our phone number is 1-800-956-6616.
Good morning, honey. Wow, the weather is beautiful, the cabin is terrific, and it's the first day of our vacation.
Yeah.
Honey, is there something wrong?
Yeah, I just realized we forgot to pack the travel Berkey system. I can't drink this cabin water. And what am I going to do when I'm out on the lake? Now the whole vacation is ruined.
Honey, cheer up. I brought our Sport Berkey purifiers.
What?
Yeah, I know you're picky about not having pathogenic bacteria, organic chemicals, heavy metals or foul tastes and odors in the water, so I packed our Sport Berkey purifiers.
You know, this is a terrific cabin, and wow, have you noticed the beautiful weather?
Don't ruin your vacation. Get a Travel Berkey today for only $209, or get a Sport Berkey for only $39. Call 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438, or order on the web at berkeywater.com. Travel Berkey not available in Iowa.
Hi, I'm Joyce Riley, and many of you know that for years I was a cardiovascular heart transplant nurse. Since that time, I have educated myself on the importance of preventative care. It all begins with providing your heart and vascular system with building blocks for good health. Strauss Heart Drops is the original formula that was copied by others but never duplicated. Strauss Heart Drops were developed by a master herbalist, Jim Strauss, after he suffered a heart attack in 1979. His doctor said he would only survive if he had heart bypass surgery, and Jim said no. He developed Strauss Heart Drops, the formula that has been copied by others but never been surpassed. Get the original Strauss Heart Drops 4-ounce bottle for only $79.99. Call the Power Hour at 877-817-9829, 877-817-9829. You've probably heard about the other products that have tried to copy the Strauss formula. Well, get the original Strauss Heart Drops by calling 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Now you can really do your heart right with Strauss Heart Drops.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at the Genesis Communication Network, and certainly we're going to be carrying Bill Federer's book. It's $20. Whatever America needs to know about the Quran, the Muslim faith and the United States. So whatever American needs to know about the Quran, it's give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Now, we've got a couple of four-tape sets on the Muslim faith. One is Islam, the Religion of Doom, four interviews with Craig Wynn, going into the background of the Muslim faith, and then, of course, we have an update on what the Muslim religion is today. So you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Let me specifically suggest Islam, the Prophet of Doom, or the Religion of Doom. The four-tape set we offer is a classic, and we'll really give you all the information you need to know. And, of course, I think you'll enjoy William Federer's book. We always enjoy having William as a guest here. To really understand the satanic nature of what's going on in the world today, you have to get my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. Now, certainly, in my lectures, we always point out that the satanic forces have infiltrated the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, the Jewish religion. There really are satanic forces here. There are people who believe that there are two gods, the good God, the bad God, and that we worship the bad God, and the people who worship the good God. Many of them are working in the highest levels of our government today. They actually worship Lucifer. And if you doubt that, of course, you need to get some of the material we offer. Material such as Hostages of the Devil, story of five exorcisms written by Malachi Martin, and you can get that book along with the four-tape set, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, at reduced price. Satanic Crimes, an excellent new book by William Kennedy. You can get the four-tape set on Satanism and Deliverance, or the four-tape set on the supernatural. You'll certainly want to get the videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll. The 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version. Sorcerers of the New Age. You want to get Constance Cumby's excellent book entitled The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. And we're putting together a great new four-tape set by Constance Cumby as well. All of these things and so much more is available from Radio Liberty. Nobody really wants to talk about the fact we're involved in a spiritual battle against satanic forces that permeate every aspect of our society today. So if you wonder what's really going on, it's very simple. It's a battle between good and evil, and the forces of evil are well organized today. And, of course, they're working at the highest levels of our government. They're poisoning our children. They're poisoning our people. They're using the wealth and military power of America to wreak devastation throughout the world. And now that you've at least heard this, we hope that many of you will want to challenge me and try to prove me wrong. Go to our webpage at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or the DVD or the video, and it's a good introduction to what's going on. Get my talk on planned population reduction, because they really are in the process of killing off most of the world's population, and the coming war in the Middle East, and that's why we're going to have a great and horrible and bloody war over there that's going to spread to this country, and there's going to be devastation here as well. That's what it's really all about. There really are people who like horror and devastation. So certainly get our material at our webpage at RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs 5 hours a day on the Internet, on various networks, 4 hours a day on shortwave, 9 hours a day on Telstar 5. And then, of course, we ask you to tell others about our program. We hope many of you will join the Radio Liberty family. Quite frankly, we need your help. I'd love to expand our network. We got 4 stations we could pick up if we had the funding, and it wouldn't be that expensive. Then we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
Black Berkey purification elements are more powerful.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.
Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And well, right now we have with us on the line Kerry Lucas, who's going to be coming, and we're going to be talking about ethanol. Is ethanol the solution to the energy crisis that we're facing today? She comes from the Independent Women's Forum, and without further ado, I'll introduce Kerry and then let her introduce herself. Hi, Kerry, how are you doing? Kerry, are you there?
Yes, sure am.
Well, why don't you sort of tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and why you think that the ethanol issue is so important?
Well, I work for a group called the Independent Women's Forum, and we are a group of women who support free markets, personal liberty, and individual responsibility, which really makes us a different kind of women's group than a lot of the traditional. When you hear a women's group, I think that people often tend to think of groups like NOW, which have a very different agenda than we do. And so, you know, we believe that all issues are women's issues, and really the energy issue is something that's so critical for our economy and for the future. And unfortunately, politicians on both sides of the aisle have been, in my mind, giving out some bad information, and by promoting things like ethanol as the solution that's going to fix everything, are really obscuring the real choices that we have before us.
All right, fine. Well, then, what's wrong with ethanol? And isn't this a good alternative to oil, since we are no longer in oils sufficient? Don't we need to be energy self-sufficient?
Well, I think, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think if we think about what, first, I think it's important to kind of define what is the challenge and what's the problem that America is facing with oil and basically, or with energy. Basically, we are a country that is a growing economy, and we require a lot of energy to make ourselves go. We need efficient and, you know, we want relatively low-cost energy, and we want it consistent. We don't want there to be shortages, and we don't want to pollute the environment. And then finally, one of the big challenges is that we right now are dependent on oil that is that we must import, and a lot of that comes from regimes which are largely hostile to the United States. And that's the big problem. And so it would be wonderful, and I think we do need to look at alternative sources of energy, both, you know, increasing domestic oil production, but then also alternatives to oil. And ethanol absolutely has a role to play in that, but it's not going to solve the problem alone. And I think that the government, unfortunately, President Bush most recently in his State of the Union address, really made it sound as though if only we start investing in more ethanol, this is going to fix things for us. And the facts just don't hold up. We need to think a little harder. And yes, ethanol can play a role, but it's not the only thing we need to do.
All right, fine. Well, Sydney, do you think that ethanol is a good substitute for oil? If we had enough ethanol, would it solve the problem, or would it compound the problem in many respects?
Well, I mean, in some respects, you know, ethanol. It's not as efficient as oil and things like running our cars, but the simple fact is that we can't, even if we took all of the corn that is currently being produced in the United States today, it really would only have a pretty small effect on the amount of oil we'd have to import. It would only be able to reduce the amount of gasoline by about 12%. So that's not going to, you know, this isn't going to change the fact that we still need to import oil from places like Venezuela.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Kerry Lucas from the Independent Women's Forum. They're a woman's think tank, a feminist group, but they're not the left-wing feminists. They're feminists who have an entirely different agenda. There are feminists who believe that limited government and freedom and liberty are the best way to live, not the socialist, the Gloria Steinem, Gloria Allred, a group of women who seem to be championing all the causes. They're doing more than anything to harm women and women's movements. Anyway, of course, Carrie's talking today about the subject of ethanol. And, of course, we hear so much, ethanol is the solution to our problem. We're going to just make enough ethanol, America then can become energy independent. The only trouble is as we use all the corn for ethanol, and so much of it, why the price of corn keeps going up. And, of course, we're exporting corn to places like Mexico. As a result, the price of the corn used to make tamales and burritos is going up, and the poor Mexicans down there, first of all, we destroyed their farmers down there by flooding the country with cheap corn, in which they couldn't compete with. It was so cheap. Now we're raising the price of corn, and they've lost their own farming industry, and so the poor Mexicans are in a real bind, but it really, it seems that whenever government enters into the free market system, they make things worse rather than better. Would you agree with that, Carrie?
Absolutely. I think that that's the real shame in all this, is that, you know, when I think about what it is that's going to be the best path to America actually achieving energy independence and really solving our energy problems, it's the answer lies in our free market economy and the fact that we have the most innovative, people out there, entrepreneurs who are, I'm sure that there are many folks who are working right now to solve the problem, to come up with an alternative source of energy or better way to make our energy more efficient. But unfortunately, they're going to be entering a field that is no longer a level playing field. You know, you think about some student at MIT who may be coming up with something that could really revolutionize our energy marketplace. And unfortunately, you know, he's going to have a tougher time raising capital. He's going to be entering a marketplace where ethanol is receiving a significant government subsidy, and it just makes it much harder for that guy to succeed. And that's the real problem, I think, that is that by putting all our eggs in this ethanol basket, we could really be taking limiting the solutions that are actually going to be out there and could really help us.
All right. Well, I certainly agree with everything you've said. So just hang on here, and we'll be back in just a moment as we pull our other stations right on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Carrie Lucas, and Carrie was simply pointing out that right now, of course, there's tremendous stress on ethanol as being the solution to our problems. I don't know how many of you remember, a few years ago, we were going to address the pollution problem by adding MTBE to our gasoline. Well, we not only polluted our gasoline, we polluted the air, we polluted our water. Gosh, and then we found out it really didn't work. And yet it was the people in Washington, D.C. had mandated this all across America because people had lobbied our elected representatives and not knowing what they were doing, not having one study that showed that MTBE decreased emissions. Why, of course, they voted for it. It became the law of the land, and now we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars paying off the law of the lawsuits that resulted because of the federal mandate. Now let's go to ethanol. Tremendous pressure from the corn states, for ethanol. And yet, of course, they tell us that this is the solution, but, well, there, a lot number of things have been raised, and one thing that Carrie just mentioned was the subsidies. It would not be efficient at all to make ethanol if they weren't getting subsidies on every gallon of ethanol they produced. How much are they putting out for the subsidy? Do we have any idea, Carrie?
Yeah, I believe it's about a dollar a gallon. I mean, it's very significant. It's really, the government is heavily subsidizing ethanol, and you're right that it just wouldn't be able to compete in the marketplace at all if it wasn't for the government doing this. And that's, you know, it's, I think that bringing up the politics of it is important because, we all want, I think there's a lot of sympathy and a lot of, goodwill towards the farmers out there, but it's not healthy for the farming industry, it's not healthy for any industry, for government to really prop something up and make it, and not let the free market do its work. There are other alternatives. You know, sugar can be converted into ethanol, and they're looking at ways to make agriculture waste be converted into ethanol. Both of those, you know, who knows? It could be that that becomes a much better alternative to oil or to corn-based ethanol. But unfortunately, it makes it harder and harder for us to know when governments just keep putting their hand on the scale and tipping it in favor of corn-based ethanol.
And, of course, a lot of people who, have a lot of good friends in Washington, D.C., have made a lot of money. So, and then, of course, the subject of the amount of energy produced, much of it by oil, that it takes to produce a gallon of ethanol. I have heard that it takes far more than a gallon's worth of oil, or, you know, to produce a gallon of ethanol. What's the solution there?
It's kind of a sad situation when, you know, the researchers, it takes a lot of energy to convert the corn into this fuel, this ethanol fuel. And, you know, the best case scenario, the researchers say that ethanol will yield about 25% more energy than it consumes. But other researchers have a far lower estimate, some even arguing that ethanol production consumes more energy than it produces, which means this is a, you know, a net negative in terms of energy creation for us and is just incredibly foolhardy. So, again, I think that's another reason to be cautious about ethanol as, you know, this cure-all, like politicians will tend to pretend it is.
And, of course, there's certain countries like Brazil that produces a lot of their gasoline, and would they add ethanol to it? But apparently, that's helped Brazil. Do we have any idea what's happened in Brazil as far as the success of ethanol?
Well, I believe that their ethanol is much more sugar based, and I think sugar based is actually a more efficient. It doesn't require as much energy. And unfortunately, the government, the United States government, is really, has some punitive policies against importing sugar and sugar-based ethanol, which is another way that the government is manipulating the market, which is, again, you know, I think just is very foolhardy. And it shows, it's not only the corn industry here that is powerful, but the sugar lobby is too. And a lot of times they try to keep out imported sugar, which is another thing we just need to really put some pressure on politicians and say, gosh, we need to get the government out of the business of picking winners and losers and let the market do its job.
Well, now, do the corn producers still get a subsidy for producing the corn as they have in the past, in addition then to the subsidy they get for making the corn into alcohol? Are they getting a sort of a double dip there, a double
subsidy?
Well,
I'm truly not sure of how this, of whether or not the normal agriculture subsidies continue to apply to corn. I would bet that they do, but I'm not sure, so I should let somebody more knowledgeable than myself speak on that. But, you know, but I think if one of the, an important kind of, another step back and think, you know, not just about this energy policy, but about government regulation in general and some of the ways that Washington, some of the things that Washington is involved in, which just becomes, so counterproductive. And I think our agriculture our agriculture industry is a perfect example of, you know, they subsidize the production of many different crops. And that while I think that people, there's a sympathy in this idea that we need to help the family farm. Everyone has a very nostalgic and very, happy view of these farmers that you want to help out. But unfortunately, that's just not the case. This is big business, and a lot of these are just rent-seeking companies that, like other corporations, are really feeding on the government and taking just massive subsidies from American taxpayers. And again, it's just, this isn't why we created the federal government in the first place, and it's really just inappropriate and time to get government back to what it's supposed to do.
Well, of course, you won't get any argument from us at all. My understanding is that, there are certain problems with using ethanol as far as the rubber hoses and other things, where the gasoline goes through, and that this has a tendency to sort of corrode or eat away and destroy the hoses. And then what happens when you have the ethanol-based fuel? What does that do to the engine and to the rings and to the very structure of the engine? Does it wear out earlier? Do we have any information?
I'm not sure of the effect on the car itself, but I know that ethanol is, you get worse mileage with ethanol-based fuel than you do with oil-based fuel. Significantly, it's significantly more it takes more ethanol to go the same distance than it does with oil-based fuel, which is another reason why, you know, this is just, you know, it's not what American consumers want. And you know, one of the things that I think politicians find it really tempting to try to keep prices low or artificially try to protect consumers from kind of the cost of energy, when in fact, you know, one of the problems with all this is that by shielding us from the cost, or, you know, subsidizing ethanol or subsidizing gasoline costs, it makes it so we're not as urgent to me to get a fuel-efficient car. You think, you know, last summer there was a lot of concern and hand-wringing over when gasoline prices went to about $3 a gallon, and, you know, I certainly did not, you know, it made me unhappy when I had to fill up my big gas tank to see more of my paycheck guzzled up. But in fact, that plays a really important role in the marketplace. It made me question, you know, I have a big SUV and it doesn't get great mileage, and it made me think, boy, next time I should really think harder about getting a fuel-efficient car. So that's just, you know, we need to recognize that prices play a role in setting, in helping monitor consumer behavior and pointing us in the right direction. And when government, you know, whether the politicians are trying to set gasoline prices or they're subsidizing different kinds of fuels, it's all just making it so the outcome that's the best, that's the most likely and the most efficient, isn't going to happen, and we don't benefit from that.
Well, you know, I think it's really so interesting. Here we see that they're trying to hold the price down of ethanol so that they subsidize the fuel, the ethanol fuel, so we can buy the gasoline ethanol mixture cheaper. But nobody ever asks, where does the government get the money to subsidize the... where does the government get that money, you know? Nobody ever asks that. They almost think that it's free money. The government's got a lot of money. Nobody ever asks where the government gets the money.
It's really, that's a really important point on so many issues. People tend to assume that, you know, if something sounds nice, government ought to subsidize it because, boy, you know, this is harmless. Nobody has to pay. It just comes from nothing, and it's such a, you know, wonderful thing when government subsidizes these, you know, nice causes. Well, in fact, this is taxpayer money, and this is, you know, hard-working Americans who are paying the bills and are really suffering the consequences of paying the cost of these subsidies, whether it's, you know, on so many of the programs and that we have out there. It really is. It's a shame. It's important that each time you hear about a government program to remember that it's you and your neighbor and the hard man, you know, hard guy working, trying to support a family and kids. They're the ones who are footing the bill of all this.
And, of course, the people who make the big money are the people, of course, who have built the ethanol plants, who are getting the subsidies from the federal government paid by you and I. And of course, their salary, their income is going up dramatically as the price of our fuel not is only going up, but the price, of course, our taxes have to go up. Because the government either has to raise taxes, it has to borrow money, or it has to print money, and by so doing it destroys the value of our currency, which is exactly what's going on today. They steal the money from us by one means or another. If you borrow the money, it's going to have to be paid back, and not the amount that you borrow, but twice that much, because, of course, the interest, of course, keeps going up year after year after year. And the problem is, in my estimation, it's all unnecessary. I mean, we've had people on our programs who said if you just put a $20 a barrel floor under oil so that the wildcatters could go out there and take the environmental restrictions off, which incidentally the big oil companies have been pushing, and they financed this whole environmental movement for years. Why would they do that? Why, very simply, so there wouldn't be any competition. There is lots of oil in government land and private land and offshore and off the North Shore, but the simple question is, do the oil companies make more money when there's an abundance of oil or when there's a shortage of oil? And if you were an oil company executive, would you rather have a shortage of oil and make $3 a gallon or an abundant oil and make 30 cents a gallon? Well, I think that you have a pretty good eye with you what the answer to that is. That's why they've subsidized the environmental movement, and they did it a long time ago. Long-term planning, as we progressively impoverish the people of America. But Rush Limbaugh is not going to tell you that part of the story. Well, I guess it's Carrie Lucas. Carrie, what's the solution here? What should we be doing? How can we, you know, solve the oil problem, solve the problem of pollution? What should we be doing to solve the problem?
Well, you know, I think that there is no easy solution, and that's something that politicians are loath to tell people. And I think that the thing we should really be agitating for is to get government out of the way, to stop picking winners and losers when it comes to favored fuels and favored companies and industries. And instead, they should be reducing regulations and trying to create an environment where entrepreneurs and are out there and are able to seek new sources of fuel, whether that's by exploring some of the domestic sources of oil. We need to think hard about things like allowing more nuclear power to be created in this country. It's really taboo, and people are this very negative perception of nuclear power, but in fact, it's some of the cleanest and most efficient fuel out there. So we really need to get government out of the way and let people and individuals and entrepreneurs start finding real solutions. That's our only hope. Government can't do it alone.
But Carrie, what are we going to do with this spent fuel? I mean, we have a nuclear power. What are we going to do with this spent fuel, the nuclear fuel?
You know, I think that my understanding is that increasingly nuclear power plants are able to be they're more environmentally friendly. There's better ways of handling. I mean, nuclear waste is absolutely a problem, but this is how Europe gets most of its energy from nuclear power plants. It's not this, there's no absolute, there are trade-offs to everything you're going to do, and all of the energy sources have some downsides and have some upsides, and certainly we need to think hard about it and make sure that it's done in a responsible way, but I know that nuclear power can be has a role to play in empowering America.
Well, one of the most amazing things is that, anytime anybody mentions the advantages of nuclear power, somebody always brings up, what are we going to do with all this spent fuel? Well, what do they do in France? Why don't we process it? Why don't we process it? Because Congress passed a law that outlawed reprocessing fuel, and the companies that had put the money to build the plants lost $4 billion. Well, when Reagan came in, and they got the legislation reversed, and the company said, fine, we want to promise, though, that you're not going to pass another law if we go out and we build the plants all over again where we lose another $4 billion. We want to guarantee that you won't, change the laws again. And they refused to give the guarantee. And so that's why we don't reprocess our fuel. Every other country, Japan, reprocesses their nuclear fuel. France and Germany and Russia, they all reprocess their nuclear fuel. We're building, nuclear plants for communist China. We're actually subsidizing five major plants for communist China, but we're not allowed to do it here in the United States. And you have to ask yourself, why doesn't anybody ever tell the American people? The solution is not to bury the nuclear fuel someplace up in Nevada. I don't know how many tens of billions or hundreds of billions of dollars we've spent on this big facility in Nevada we're not allowed to use, because, of course, they have to guarantee that it won't leak fuel for 100 million years or something like that. All you have to do is reprocess the fuel. They know that. Isn't it amazing when you control the media, you have freedom of the press? That is freedom to suppress the information. The solution, of course, is to reprocess the fuel. And we're going to be back here in just a moment with Carrie Lucas and talking about, ethanol and other energy problems. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at the Radio Liberty. Our guest is Carrie Lucas, and we've been talking about how are we going to solve the problems of energy and our dependence upon energy, because, ladies and gentlemen, the Kyoto Protocol, it has nothing to do with global warming. After all, greenhouse gases are only 3% of the global, CO2 is only about 3% of the global, of the greenhouse gases. I mean, well over 95% of it. Greenhouse gases are water vapor. Are we going to outlaw that? No, of course not. I mean, it's all a scam. But it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is. If you say it often enough, people will believe. And, of course, really what this whole thing about greenhouse gases and global warming is really about is an attack on the economic infrastructure of America and society. and an effort to simply destroy our abilities for manufacturing and, of course, to impoverish our people and then redistribute our wealth to other countries. That's what it's really about. But, of course, they're not going to tell us that. How do you counter the people, Kerry, who talk about, well, but we can't have nuclear power. What about Chernobyl? What about Three Mile Island?
Yeah, it is. It's you know, and there certainly have been some, you know, some terrible things have happened, and in the same way that there have been oil spills, and there have been a lot of bad things that happened in the past. But one thing that's wonderful is our technology keeps getting better and better. So these things can be done much more safely and much more environmentally friendly. You know, it's in nobody's interest to have our environment destroyed. I really think that it's something that most people are very conscious of, and increasingly energy providers are conscious of it. So I think that's a real, it's such a caricature of where we are today and the kind of technologies that exist today.
Well, of course, what about Three Mile Island? I mean, didn't a lot of people die? Didn't that do tremendous harm?
You know, I'm not sure the extent of the harm. I bet that it's probably not as bad as the reputation of it is. But it's certainly, you know, nobody likes to hear about, you know, nuclear leaks and anything that affects the environment and has a negative impact like that. But it is the kind of thing that we need to, realize that we've come a long way in the last, in 20 years or 30 years. And we have much, much safer ways to do such things.
Kerry, I'm not going to ask you how old you are, but I'm old enough to remember how that was the most beautifully stated thing. It just so happened that they happened to get that so-called leak there at Three Mile Island exactly the same time a motion picture was coming out starring Jane Fonda and Jack Lemmon called The China Syndrome. The idea was a leak in a nuclear power plant, and they were afraid it was going to melt down all the way to China on the other side of the world. Actually, there are far more people died at Ted Kennedy's car at Chappaquiddick than died as a result of what happened at Three Mile Island. There was minimal release of nuclear energy. There was no hydrogen bomb. They played the American people like it play a guitar or a violin. And they really convinced them this was a terrible tragedy. And what happened at Chernobyl was simply because they didn't have a containment vessel. I mean, we have containment vessels here. There's no way for the nuclear energy pack to get out of those things. Here, they're over in Russia at Chernobyl. They had a building with a tar and gravel roof. There was a containment vessel. And it just shows what happens when you have government building power plants rather than private industry.
Yep. Well, that's a really good point. And I think that the one thing that that is really, really frustrating is you've got the media sensationalism over problems that come out, whether it's, last summer when the prices of gasoline inched up, and, you know, it definitely hurt. It was a significant increase over where the lows of how inexpensive gasoline had previously been. But the media made it seem as though this was just, just the most Armageddon terrible scenario that gasoline was over $3 a gallon. And when in fact, most Americans recognize what was going on. We may have, taken a few less, long road trips. But it wasn't the end of the world, and this is a very healthy way that the market deals with scarcity, and it encouraged people to consume a little less gasoline. And then you think about something like global warming today. You're absolutely right that there is this almost a hysteria about global warming and its potential. And one of the most disturbing things is that there's such a disconnect between the extent of the problem and then the possibilities of the solutions. Where if you believe that the globe is our climate is warming and it's caused by humans, well, then the Kyoto Protocol would do so little. I mean, the Kyoto Protocol would be far too modest to actually reverse the harm we're doing. The globe would continue to warm, and all the catastrophic things that everybody says would happen anyway. But in the process, it would also just ruin the economy and ruin the chance to have real innovations that could actually address some problems. So I think that there is that so much of the environmentalist movement does feed on people's fears, and we just need to think a little harder. And it's unfortunate that so much of the media does a bad job in talking about some of the real trade-offs that are out there.
I agree with you totally. People have to understand that the media is controlled, and the media is lying to us. And the media will tell you, that the polar ice caps are melting, and to an extent they are. We are having global warming. And I always ask people, why do they call Greenland Greenland?
We'll be right back.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at the Carrie Lucas, and Carrie is simply pointing out, I think, with something so true. This whole thing about global warming is really an attack on the industrial foundation of America. Destroy our industrial foundation, and it will be destroyed if we have to cut back our energy consumption 30%. Why, of course, they will destroy our manufacturing, and then, of course, can all be the rest of it. That's what we still have left can be shipped to other countries as we move America from a first world country to a third world country. Carrie, what can we do to make the American people realize we're being lied to?
Well, I think that having common sense conversations, and really, you know, I personally find, you know, I'm not a climatologist, and I find it difficult to separate out all of the different research that's out there. And so I think that as much as we can, we need to be, you know, try to get ourselves educated, but also take a little bit of a skeptical view and think hard about, well, does the solution fix the problem that they're claiming to? That's the thing that really bothers me about so much of the global warming conversation is that, you know, these potentially catastrophic events just have no bearing on the solution they present, would do nothing to prevent the catastrophic events. So clearly there's got to be something else going on here. And getting ourselves as educated as possible, but also just keeping a cool head. We've got, you know, this isn't something that's happening and is going to, you know, ruin the world tomorrow. We need to take a little time and figure out what's going on and not jump to any quick conclusions and let policymakers, you know, push us in a crazy direction.
And there was that wonderful movie that came out about a couple of years ago. It was called The Day After Tomorrow, and it was about this massive ice storm that hit the East Coast, and everybody was freezing to death, and there was massive floods and a breakdown of society, and they blamed this massive freezing cold that was killing people. I mean, this thing just swept in all of a sudden, and people would freeze to death right on the spot. But it was all related to global warming.
I think everything's related. You know, any weather event, whether it's, you know, a hurricane or you know, a thunderstorm, a lot of people want to point right to global warming and to, you know, the human effect on the climate. When I think we need to be a little bit humble. One of the things that's amazing, if you think about just how short human history is, how much even shorter the industrial world is, you know, the time that we've been producing any gases at all, and recognize that there have been wild swings in the climate over, you know, the millions of years that the Earth has been in existence, and, you know, we just need to be a little bit, seeing one trend or another does not mean that's the absolute on how, you know, that it's absolutely a human caused thing.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest today is Carrie Lucas from the Independent Women's Forum. Carrie, do you have a website or a telephone number or any information you'd like to get out?
I sure do. Please come and visit the Independent Women's Forum website, which is www.iwf.org, and we have a lot of information, not only on energy policy, but on, you know, a whole bunch of issues that I hope will be of interest to your listeners.
All right, fine. And so, basically, give that website one more time.
It's www.iwf.org.
All right,
for Independent Women's Forum.
All right, fine. Now, if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And, of course, we're talking about this whole energy shortage scam and how they, you know, they're frightening us to death and how we have to have ethanol, but ethanol actually certainly doesn't save any energy because it takes certainly the equivalent of a gallon of oil to produce a gallon of ethanol, and then we've got to subsidize the ethanol on top of it to the tune of 70 cents to a dollar a gallon, so we just keep going further and further behind. The only people who really seem to be doing well are those farmers and the people who are building the ethanol plants with government subsidies. And, of course, we have the scam. We can't have nuclear power. It's all right for us to build nuclear power plants in North Korea for the North Koreans, and it's all right for us to subsidize the building of 5 nuclear power plants in China, and that's being done by the Export-Import Bank. We're guaranteed the $5 billion for building the 5 nuclear power plants. And Westinghouse is going to build them, but remember, Westinghouse used to be an American corporation. It's not. That's now a Chinese owned corporation. But we're going to subsidize it anyway. We certainly want to keep the Japanese happy, don't we? But the problem is, why can't we build nuclear power plants in America? Oh, they'll show you a picture of a nuclear mushroom cloud, and oh, we can't have that. And yet, there's never been a nuclear explosion in any civilian nuclear power plant. My son spent many years in the Navy. I'm an aircraft carrier, and you know what powers that aircraft carrier? Nuclear power. What do you think powers our submarines, our nuclear submarines? Exactly the same nuclear power. And these guys live right next door to it. And everybody, I'll never forget, I went to a meeting one time, and we got some very misinformed young man came up, and we got talking about nuclear power. He was furious with me because I supported it. And he said, would you want to have a nuclear power plant in your backyard? He thought he really had me, you know. And I said, well, look, my son was in the military and on an aircraft carrier, and right down below him there, they had the nuclear power plant that was providing the energy to propel that amazingly big ship through the waves, you know, at 40, 50 miles an hour. And he's as healthy as he can be. Why is he so worried about it? He got so mad, he just stomped off and yelling and screaming. And the tragedy is, Kerry, so many people have never thought of what's going on today. All they hear is this one side of the issue. And that's because, well, do you ever have a feeling that sometimes the media is not giving us the whole story?
Yeah, I do. I definitely think that too much of the time the media isn't thinking, you know, likes the easy answers and certainly loves the potential, you know, the kind of sensationalist claims that a lot of the environmentalists will make. Things like global warming and these, you know, Al Gore visions of the future can be very appealing in terms of media. You know, the good news is that there are, you know, we happen to live in a time when there's a whole lot of alternative sources of media, and at least we have some variety, and you can seek out different views. So it's not just, we're not just at the mercy of, you know, three networks as we were not too many years ago. But it remains a problem getting the straight story from the press.
Amen to that. Well, let's go to Bob, who's calling us from Idaho, and once again, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Do you hear me all right?
You're doing just fine, yeah?
Okay, yeah. I remember years ago I read a book called Megatrends.
Right.
And on page 77 of that book, it said more or less that the goal of world peace could be met by building up the third world. And, of course, what they didn't say in that book was the way to build up the third world was to decimate the United States. And
that's all about an attack. It's an attack on America. They know what they're doing. They just don't want us to know.
Well, you know, as we go back to Earth Day, I know you remember it, but probably the youngsters don't. That is that essentially overnight on pretty near every campus in this whole country, and here in Pocatello, Idaho, even our little local university, overnight the environmental movement was born out of the anti-Vietnam movement. I'm sure you remember that, and I remember J. Edgar Hoover saying in the same time period that the Communist Party was behind much of the anti-war movement. Do you remember that, Doctor?
Sure, and of course, they're behind it today. But, of course, what everybody has forgotten about Earth Day. Kerry, do you know what whose birthday Earth Day is?
No, I don't.
It's
Vladimir.
Vladimir Lenin.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
And the communists laugh at us. We're so stupid. Yeah. But you have to understand that they're not very smart either, because they don't understand what, of course, we point out in the book Foundations to Power and Influence, which, of course, is a product of the Reese Committee report, congressional report that came out in 1954, that pointed out that this whole movement in America was financed by our great tax-exempt foundations, the Rockefeller, Ford, and Carnegie, and the other great tax-exempt foundations. They're funding communism. I have subscribed to the communist publications that push the environmental movement and all of these things for 44 years. They never attack the Council on Foreign Relations, or the Rockefeller Foundation, or the Ford Foundation, or the Carnegie Foundation. Why? Because they're the ones who are behind this whole communist movement. They control what the environmental movement, they control the anti-environmental movement, they control the pro-war movement, the anti-war movement. You always want a controlled opposition. Anything else you want to say, Bob?
Well, yeah, Doctor, just as I would like to add to that, it was celebrated worldwide as Lenin's 100th anniversary of his birth, and, you know, you can't, and of course in this country it was celebrated as Earth Day, but Doctor, what's your feeling? Essentially, the energy cartels more or less have our palates by the throats, and do you feel that perhaps that the Reds are behind trying to move the great religions of the world at each other's throats, that they might pick up the pieces?
No. Communism, from its very inception, was funded by the United States and by the very people we're talking about. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. And then, of course, you need to get books like Wall Street and the Rise of Bolshevism. You need to get Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. I mean, the leading historian of the last century, you know, in his book Tragedy and Hope, laughs at the foolish people who really thought it was the communists who were behind everything that was going on, you know, in turning Eastern Europe and China over to the communists. And he said it was never the communists. It was always these people. He called them the Anglo-American establishment. He was part of it.
I know
how that really fooled everybody.
I know Cleon Skousenbeck wrote a book called The Naked. Well, he wrote two books.
Yeah,
Naked,
it's a great
Capitalist
book.
And The Naked Communist. And it was very interesting when he made the comment that it was the capitalists in this country and, of course, the free world that seemed to be building it up. And I might go back to Frederick Engels, Doctor, and I'm sure you've crossed this in your research over the years, that Frederick Engels, who was really Marx's cohort and sponsor, but he made the comment that they would use the women's liberation movement to also advance. So when we see Nancy Pelosi two heartbeats away from the president, that sort of bothers me a little bit.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Bob.
Thank you very much. Oh. We appreciate your show, Doctor.
Bye-bye. Okay. Well, anyway, of course, there's so much to this entire story. So, certainly, Kerry, you would like to see we get government out of the business. And I really think that if you did not have all the government and environmental regulations, the world would be awash with oil. In fact, they have to have an oil cartel, OPEC, not to, you know, to limit production of oil in the oil-producing companies to keep the price up. And if they did away with the cartel, why we would have oil down, you know, at 50 cents a gallon, if the government, of course, weren't having to, you know, do a tack on another 50 or 70 cents in the way of taxes.
You know, and I think that there's other, you know, the other thing with the government imposes, you know, it's not just the direct things on energy, but you just think about the huge burden that government creates through our tax code and through the other regulatory environments that really makes it hard for businesses to survive and compete. And that means that a lot of potential alternatives, I think that's one of the real tragedies, is that, you know, perhaps there would be better alternatives to oil that would be out there if we could let the entrepreneurs and the, you know, the engineers out there really unleash their minds and be able to really research and invest in creating new alternatives. But unfortunately, we have we're better than most places in the world, but we still have a business climate which can be really which is a real impediment to some to developing new technologies and to getting them to market. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, when we think about what the federal government is supposed to do, we need to get back to the basics and remember why the federal government was created in the first place. And it wasn't to micromanage industries. It wasn't to have a bunch of transfer programs taking some taxpayer tax money from some taxpayers and giving it to other constituents. It was, you know, to do things like protect and defend the country, and that's about it. It wasn't supposed to be doing a whole lot more. So we need to get back to that and really start thinking about the proper role of the federal government.
And isn't it amazing? I mean, the one function of the federal government was to defend our country from invasion. And yet, of course, we have between 20 and 30 million illegal immigrants who invaded our country, and the government isn't trying to protect our country from an invasion. It's doing everything they can to encourage these illegal immigrants coming into the country. So maybe they ought to get back to their original function, to offend America and get out of trying to regulate every aspect of human endeavor, because I can't think of any problem facing America today that another government program won't make worse.
Well, that's, you know, that's absolutely true. That so often government programs have these unintended consequences of messing up or eliminating some of the foundations of our society and civil society. And you think of things like the welfare programs, which really eroded some of the nonprofit and important civil institutions, which were helping people in need, which we all recognize is something that we need to have in society. But just because we need to have it in society doesn't mean government needs to do it. Better left, if it's left to the people and communities, they're going to do a much better, more responsible job than when we have, put Uncle Sam in charge and we don't have to worry about that anymore. It's much better when individuals are engaged in their local communities instead of just having, this big amorphous federal government in it. Teetering in every aspect of our lives.
Well, in fact, when I was growing up, and even as a young doctor, of course, every community had a county hospital. And the good doctors went out there and gave their time for nothing to take care of the people in need, and of course, you could always get good care, and we took good care of our patients. We didn't have, 15 nurses sitting on the ward filling out papers. We had a lot of LVNs and the people out taking care of the patients, and the nurse was a head nurse, and she wasn't looking over her shoulder trying to get the paperwork filled out for the federal officials when they came around. And we had a very efficient health care service, and nobody died. I got an email from a young man today, and they're immigrants to this country. They're wonderful, wonderful people, but they don't have any money. And the brother got ill and had to go to the hospital. Apparently had a bleeding ulcer. And, 3 days in the hospital, $28,000. Where are they going to get $28,000? And of course they make too much for Medicare or Medi-Cal. And what we have done because of government interference. I can remember when a hospital room was $13 a day. And now, of course, if we get by with, you can get up to $13,000 a day, to be in the hospital. I know I was in there one time overnight, didn't even get a meal, and my bill was over $10,000 just for the hospital. And it's all because of government interference in the health care delivery system. So, certainly we do not need the federal government looking after the health of people. And if you think medicine is expensive now, you just wait till government provides all of the health care.
Yeah. Well, that's totally true. And again, I think it goes back to recognizing where costs come from and the fact that government money isn't free. And you're absolutely right. As if we move in the direction of having government provide all of the health care for quote-unquote free, well, we are going to see just an enormous, enormous bill. It's going to be incredibly costly, both in terms of the actual dollars spent and the quality of care being sacrificed. Because if you look around the globe at where there is socialized medicine, there's always rationing. There isn't innovation in the way that, the United States, we continue to churn out and to find cures for horrible ailments and are really, helping extend longevity and make people live healthier. And gosh, we'd be really sacrificing a lot if we keep moving in the direction of letting government take it over. But it's unfortunate because I think you're right. There are so many problems in the healthcare industry, but many of them are government has created. But unfortunately, people, it's very tempting to push government to solve these problems when, in fact, the best thing government can do to solve these problems is to try to, wiggle its way back out so we can get back to an actual, individual a healthcare system which is based on individuals and on market competition, just like the other industries in the country.
And, of course, if we could get government out of the environmental movement and tying up land so the wildcatters can't look for oil and for drilling for oil and natural gas and let them drill offshore and let them drill up in Anwar, up in Alaska. They talk about the pristine wilderness there. Have you ever seen Alaska up above, up above Fairbanks? I've been there. And there's nothing, absolutely nothing. And we could drill off the North Shore. There's more oil up there than there is in all of Arabia. There is no oil shortage. If you got government out and allowed people to drill, of course, the world would be awash with oil, in my estimation. Gasoline would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 cents a gallon, and we would not have the problems we do today. But they don't want a solution.
They want a problem, and they will use that problem then to regulate us. That's what it's really all about. There's nothing new under the sun. And we're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up today's program. Our guest has been Kerry Lucas. Kerry, one more time, your webpage so people will know how to get your organization.
Yes, www.iwf.org. There's a lot of information, not just on energy policy, but on other issues I hope will be of interest to your listeners.
And, of course, the energy problem, you know, has been created. Yes, there is global warming. Global warming began about 1600, and we've increased about three-quarters of a degree during the last century, most of it before 1940. That's the truth, but you're never going to get that from the media because it's controlled by five mega corporations who control what the American people hear, read, see, and ultimately what most Americans believe. Well, Kerry, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. This has been a really fun conversation. And I hope that, you know, your listeners out there are a little bit more skeptical of the politicians' promises about being able to solve things like our energy problem with a quick fix, like just pushing us towards more corn-based ethanol. And instead, take a look at some of the research and some of the facts out there. And that, you know, when it comes to energy policy and to ethanol in particular, the simple fact is that ethanol, even if we dedicated all of our corn resources into creating ethanol, it wouldn't make a big difference in the amount of gasoline, the amount of oil we need. So it's not going to solve our problems, and in fact, it can create a lot more problems. Ethanol has some consequences for the environment. It's not as efficient, and it's simply going to use all of our corn for ethanol is going to leave a lot of people unhappy with their food bills, both because of the price of corn going up and a lot of the products that depend on corn, from cattle and our meats to a lot of other things that are in our stores the prices are going to climb. So consumers are going to be the ones who end up paying for this.
And I think that's really so significant because they're using all the corn for the subsidized ethanol that is being produced today. Now the price of corn and grain are going up. And with the increasing price of grain, then of course the feed cattle, the feedlots are going to be having to charge you more for the meat that you buy. And the same thing will be true as far as any animal that is actually going ahead and producing that. And of course, one problem leads to another problem leads to another problem. But nobody ever stops and thinks about that back in Washington, D.C. The lobbyists are there who get big bucks for convincing the legislators ethanol is the solution, without ever stopping to see what's happened in other countries where they've done exactly the same thing. And then one problem leads to another. And of course, if they're not making enough money off the ethanol, they'll just have to increase the subsidies. But where is the money going to come from? And then one of these days, you're going to begin to find that there are increasing artificial shortages. And well, anyway, Kerry, thank you very much for being with us. It's been a fun time, and I hope we can get you or somebody else from the Independent Women's Forum back here on Radio Liberty in the not-too-distant future.
Sounds terrific. Well, thank you so much for having me on tonight. You take care.
All right, bye-bye. And let me simply suggest that the problems we have are all artificially created. And as I said earlier, there is no problem facing America today that a new series of federal laws will not make far worse. The only thing government's good at is killing people. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and certainly this is the time when I need to remind all of our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if you agree with me that we're involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield, and there really are people who would like to kill off most of the people in the world. And they laid out their plan at the Georgia Guidestones in Elberton, Georgia, where they're at this occult center where they have their satanic ceremonies, and the UFOs hover over the top of it, and they have their naked ceremonies, and the witches meet. Why, they're engraved in stone is the plan that comes from the dark side, which says, first point, maintain the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature, which means Well, in a world of over 6 billion people, they're going to have to kill off over 90% of the world population. If you'd like to see pictures of the Georgia Guidestones, go to our webpage at radioliberty.com. If you'd like to read my treatise on population control, it's up on my webpage at radioliberty.com under the Population Control Agenda Monograph. Now, if you'd like to get into the background of what we were talking about today, as far as oil is concerned, why, let me suggest that you get the Oil Deception, a 4-tape set we put out. If you want to understand what's happening, why your electricity bill is going up, we have a syllabus on that, as well as a 4-tape set on electricity. And we even have a video where we went into the background of that. And if you request my newsletters on electricity, we'll tell you how they created a situation in the name of, oh my goodness, electricity is so expensive, we're going to have to deregulate electricity, and that'll bring the price down. Competition. We need competition. Knowing full well that it wouldn't eliminate competition, because you can't deregulate a monopoly. All you can do is drive the prices up, and that's why the price of electricity has gone up. This is what they planned. Why? Because they want you to conserve. Electricity is so cheap to produce when properly done. We would have all the electricity that we could possibly need at a fraction of what we're paying now, but they want to lower your living standards. They want to impoverish our people. They want to destroy our industry, and they're well on their way to doing it. If you want to read the master plan, it's contained in our sustainable development syllabus and video. It's called the Earth Charter. If you don't want to get a copy, you can go up on the internet and pull one down, or we'll send you one free of charge, where they call for equitable distribution of wealth between nations. Well, would you like equitable distribution of wealth between Mexico and the United States? Because you know what's going to happen to your wealth. It's not going to be flowing in here from Mexico, tell them. Or as I love to say, I mean, what they really want to do is raise the living standards of the American people to that of the Mexican peasant. And if you don't think that's going to happen when our currency collapses, you really don't understand the master plan. There really are evil and wicked people out there. You need to read my newsletters. They're all posted at RadioLiberty.com. But you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or watch the DVD, or certainly the VHS. They're all available from Radio Liberty. If you want to understand what's happening with oil, the 4-tape set, the oil deception, with electricity and why electricity rates are going up, why it's electricity and the electricity syllabus, to understand the master plan, sustainable development, the video, the 4-tape set and the syllabus, the war in Iraq, the untold story, the video and the syllabus, how they're poisoning our children with fluoride and water fluoridation, and read the scientific studies that most doctors have never read, because the medical society tells them, oh, fluoride is effective and safe, and that's how they're getting away with poisoning our children. Why, of course, the hidden agenda and the hidden agendable syllabus. And, of course, autism, the 4-tape set on that, and, of course, the material we have on autism. One in every 100 people in New Jersey, children today, are autistic. And it didn't happen by accident. They're simply poisoning our children. They know what they're doing. There really are wicked people out there. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.
was a marketing campaign that was more trouble than it was worth. The drug giant Merck and Company. Correspondent Chris Newmarker reports on the story.
Merck is immediately suspending its lobbying campaign to persuade state legislatures to mandate that adolescent girls get the company's new vaccine against cervical cancer. The idea was to make the vaccine a requirement for school attendance, but the New Jersey-based drug maker had been criticized by parents and doctors groups for quietly funding the campaign via third party.
Some were calling the drug company's campaign the open bribery of public officials. An 18-year-old Utah man is suing a polygamous church leader so he can get back in touch with his mother. Johnny Jessup says he was one of several boys kicked out of the church by Warren Jeffs for being just because they were seen as competition to older men seeking young brides. Jessup says he hasn't talked to his mother.